You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, the 2020 U.S. Census is being printed without a controversial citizenship question. But federal officials are saying things could still change. We'll get the latest and we'll look back at the history of the census. First, the State Assembly passed two bills last month that would strengthen certain penalties for drunk driving. Authored by Republican Jim Ott, the bills passed with unanimous voice votes and have the support of the Wisconsin Chiefs of Police Association. One of the state's most powerful lobbying groups, the Tavern League, is remaining neutral. The bills have yet to be taken up by the state Senate, which isn't expected to be back in session until this fall. Jeremy Arney is an assistant professor of political science and public administration at UW La Crosse. Jeremy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me back.
The State Assembly has passed these two bills, one that would require a court appearance for a first OWI offense. The other would create a mandatory minimum prison sentence of 5 years if someone is killed in an OWI offense. In the context of Wisconsin's current alcohol laws, how significant is it that these were passed by the Assembly at this point?
Well, on its face, it looks like progress, right? So you have two very more strict laws being passed out of this committee up into the Senate. So it looks good up front, but those similar bills, the one that would require someone to be in court for the first offense and then also a mandatory prison imprisonment minimum of 5 years, have in some way, shape, or form been introduced in the past in the legislature. And so it looks like, because Representative Ott is a member of the committee that and also is the author of many of these bills that come out in the last 10 years, it looks like that they're fine with it, the Assembly. But from what I can tell, once it hits the Senate, it just doesn't make it onto the priority list and usually dies. There are a couple that have made it that we can talk about later if you'd like.
Sure. And I want to back up to that one bill that would require a court appearance for a first OWI offense. What happens currently when someone gets that first offense?
It's like a traffic ticket. It's a traffic violation. They're not required to show up in court. So Representative Ott's idea is that if an individual has to go through the experience of facing a judge, that they're not going to, you know, this is going to be a deterrent for future OWI offenses.
And likewise with the mandatory minimum prison sentence of 5 years, if someone is killed as a result of that OWI offense, what happens now? What happens? What kind of prison sentence, if any, is someone likely to get?
It's up to the discretion of the judge. So, as once again, Representative Ott has mentioned that he has confidence that most judges are going to put people away if they kill somebody in an OWI offense, but that he did have knowledge of someone or a judge that actually only sentenced someone to like 11 months after they'd killed somebody in prison. So this is just to make it a mandatory 5-year sentence.
As you said, Representative Ott has been championing these types of reforms for quite a while. Are there other individuals or groups that have been consistently for strengthening the OWI legislation?
Well, yeah, you've got your Wisconsin Chiefs of Police Association that are definitely on board for passing stricter laws. But then you also have opposition with the Wisconsin Counties Association because this is more work on their plate if this happens.
And one of the arguments against OWI-related bills has been the cost, and that cost is on the court system, on law enforcement. Is there a way for these new bills to be able to address those concerns in order to move forward?
Yeah, I think that the first one that deals with the court appearance, that person is going to have to pay a court fee and a fine to the county where the offense was committed. And then that goes into the county's treasury, and that goes to – it's kind of earmarked for treatment and prevention programs. So in a sense, it's not a fiscal cost to the state. It's more of a cost to the individual perpetrator. It's similar to the ignition lock program that was introduced back in 2017, that the individual has to pay for the device and the monitoring of that.
There has also been concern raised that this is not, if you want to limit drunk driving, these are not the ways to do it. But what do we know about other states that do have stricter OWI legislation and punishment, and how effective that has been there?
Well, the bottom line is that in our state is known to be a heavy drinking state and have a heavy drinking culture. And so that tends to be institutionalized or baked in to our systems, if you want, because of our lax OWI laws and because of our extremely low beer tax that we have in the state. So other states definitely have stricter OWI laws and drinking and driving laws for sure. I think we're the only state that still makes the first offense a traffic violation. So there's that. We just don't, and our beer tax is so low, as I had mentioned, second lowest in the country. So other people have addressed that. It seems that the political will in other states has been there because everybody knows that drinking and driving is a moral issue, a moral problem, and is wrong. But the political will has been lacking in this state. So we give a lot of upfront face that we're addressing this issue, but we really haven't done anything besides I think Representative Ott was given Governor Walker signed into law in 2014 the seventh, eighth, or ninth offense of OWI. You get no less than 3 years in prison, and if you get a tenth offense, then no less than four. These aren't that strict, right? I mean, who's going to wait around for 7, 8, 9, and 10 to put somebody in jail for such a minimal time? So these are issues that need to be addressed. And it was for the 7th, 8th, 9th, and 10th offense, but it hasn't been for the 5th and 6th offense. Those have just sat there in committees for the Senate committees.
We're talking with Jeremy Arney right now. He's an assistant professor of political science and public administration at UW-La Crosse, joining us from our studios there. And we are talking about efforts to strengthen the legislation about how OWI offenses are punished. And Jeremy, you know, we've been talking about how Wisconsin is really an outlier on this. And our news department did a 2-week series about Wisconsin's relationship with alcohol. Surely there are in other states people who do profit off of the, you know, drinking and socializing and things like that. And especially you said now, you know, some law enforcement organizations are in support of these tighter restrictions. What is it about Wisconsin that this doesn't play out in the same way it might somewhere else?
Well, to answer the first part of your question about those that are in support of drinking, that last bill that I just talked about in 2014, which in addition allowed more emergency personnel, law enforcement, phlebotomists, and others to undertake chemical testing of blood and urine tests on OWIs. And if there was an individual under 16 in the vehicle, then you had to be put in imprisonment for less than 3 months, or 3 months at least, or less, and not more than 1 year. So, and what's interesting is that the Tavern League was in favor of that bill in 2014, but Miller Coors was neutral back then. And Wisconsin Counties Association still took a stance against it, and it all comes back to the workload. So currently, district attorneys are swamped, and they don't have enough personnel to handle the cases that are currently being processed. So if you increase enforcement and implement these stricter laws, you're going to have even that much more to deal with. And as you mentioned at the top, the fiscal part is just – it kills it every time. And so if you can find a way to make the violator the one that pays for these policy solutions that we're talking about, then maybe that might give it a little more clout and pass and get signed by the legislature and the governor.
You mentioned that Wisconsin has one of the lowest beer tax rates in the country. Where do those beer tax dollars go in other states? Is that a possible source of revenue?
Yeah, in some states they have earmarked them for treatment and prevention programs, and we tried that here. But there's lots of problems with implementing a beer tax, and people don't like earmarked anything. And then so your alternative is to throw it into the general fund if you have increased revenues from a beer tax. And nobody likes to do that because you can't really follow, well, where is it actually being spent? So it's kind of a catch-22, right? So you can't earmark it for treatment and prevention, but you also can't throw it in the general fund because people don't like that. Another thing is that all the interest groups that you get involved to help support such an increase. You've got the Homeless Veterans Association. You've got the Wisconsin Chiefs of Police. You've got the Wisconsin Hospitals Association, doctors, all that. They want a piece of the pie. And in the past, we've only increased it by just so We tried to increase it by 2.3 cents. So basically, it would bring our tax up to 3 cents a bottle of beer, where in other states like Alaska, it's $1.21.
The tax itself is $1.21.
The tax itself, yeah. So we're really on the low end of the spectrum there.
And Jeremy, as we start to wrap up, are there ways that other states have been able to turn the tide at some point? I'm guessing that there were other states who might have been more on the lower end of how seriously drunk driving is punished and were able to make a change. Are there any lessons out there that Wisconsin might be able to learn?
Sure. If we can get the legislators to just sell this, any type of solution with these stricter OWI laws or an increase in beer tax as a public health issue, I mean, because it is. The CDC had us in 2018 as ranking 6th in OWI offenses and 7th in consumption rates. If we can convince the public that this is a real issue, a problem, and it's a public health issue, it's not a punishment issue or we're just trying to raise fines or get money through, you know, off the backs of the citizens. But no, it's a way to actually address the public health issues with drinking and driving and overconsumption and having, you know, being pregnant and drinking and all the different aspects that Wisconsin faces at a harsher rate than others, but the others have actually had that political will, as I mentioned before, to do something about it. And I think the problem is that we haven't sold it as a public health issue yet, and we're still looking at it as a fine. And nobody likes taxes pretty much anywhere, and nobody likes taxes in this state. So that's why it's been 50 years now since Wisconsin's increased the tax on a 31-gallon keg of beer from $1 to $2. And if you put that in perspective across the nation, the average currently now is probably somewhere around $20, $25, and we're still at the $2 mark. So that just shows the work that we have to do as a state.
Well, Jeremy, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you very much for having me back.
Jeremy Arney is an assistant professor of political science and public administration at UW-La Crosse. He talked with us about two OWI-related bills that passed the state assembly and why passing tougher drunk driving laws is slow going here in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the back and forth over a citizenship question on the next U.S. Census and look back at the history of how we measure our population. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. The U.S. Supreme Court said last week that the Trump administration's reason for adding a citizenship question to the 2020 census wasn't adequate, sending the decision back to a lower court. That led Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross to release a statement Tuesday saying the census had begun printing without the controversial question. But a day later, President Trump and Justice Department officials said they still intend to find a way to get a question on citizenship included. The U.S. Census has never been delayed in its more than 200-year history, but it has been the source of debates about which Americans get counted and how. Margot Anderson is a distinguished professor emerita at UW-Milwaukee. She's the author of several books, including The American Census, A Social History. Margot, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
What do you make, as a scholar of the census, of the last 2 days of back and forth over whether this citizenship question will make it onto the census this year or next year?
I think, like you and everybody else, where it's been quite a couple days and it's a moving target. And how it's going to play out, I think we'll take reading the news for the next week or so.
So have there been high-profile disagreements in the past about a particular aspect of the census or a question that should be or shouldn't be asked, like this conflict we're having now?
There have always been questions about the census and how to do it and how much it costs and whether it's accurate or not and how to apportion seats in Congress after you collect the data. But this kind of the sort of back and forth we're in now is really, in my view, unprecedented because it is we've already gone through the litigation and court process, seemingly resolved the issue in the courts, and yet it's still up in the air.
And as we said, the census has never been delayed. Is there a way to do it? President Trump has mentioned that as well, of delaying it until he can get the answer he wants. Is there any mechanism for delaying a census?
The date for the census, April 1st in the year zero, is set in the statute in what is called Title 13 of the United States Code. So Congress sets when we do the census and when the Census Bureau has to publish the results and give them the numbers for apportionment. So it would take, as far as I can see, an act of Congress to change that April 1st date.
So, of course, the issue right now is a question, whether there should be a question asking the citizenship of the person responding to the census. Have we seen a question about American citizenship being a part of the census in the past?
Yes, we have, but not in the form that the Trump administration and Secretary Ross proposed. It has been asked repeatedly of the foreign-born population, mostly from about 1890 through about 1950 on the main census form before we went to a sample design on the census. And since 1970, it's been on either what used to be called the long form census or on now what is called the American Community Survey. So we do collect data on the citizenship population, the citizenship population in the United States, but we do it on a sample basis.
No matter what the time period, it seems like questions about who belongs, who counts, who's really American find their way into the census. How much does the census reflect the current atmosphere in the country?
I think it always does. And every decade, whatever the political issues of the day are, will infuse the census discussion. So one of the examples I always use in discussions is that when the results of the census 100 years ago, namely the 1920 census, came out, the Census Bureau reported that the United States had become an urban nation for the first time, so that more people lived in urban areas than in rural areas. That prompted Congress at the time to refuse to reapportion itself for the entire decade of the 1920s. They literally couldn't believe the numbers at the time, because the U.S., of course, at that point had been a rural nation for almost 300 years. So the question of who Americans are, and by region, by race and ethnicity, by economic characteristics, always gets tangled up in the decennial census.
We're talking about the history of the U.S. Census with Margot Anderson. She's a distinguished professor emerita at UW-Milwaukee. She's the author of several books, including The American Census, A Social History. And Margot, one of the interesting things you've researched is the role that census data played in the internment of Japanese American citizens during World War II. Tell us about that.
During World War II, or actually a few weeks after Pearl Harbor, the Census Bureau published tabulations by race, and Japanese was considered a race, from the 1940 census. The military requested technical support from the Census Bureau to to organize the what became the evacuation and incarceration of over 100,000 people from the West Coast. The debate over that doing that at the time was quite public, by the way. Most Americans knew about it, and it was written up in the New York Times and other major newspapers. So what the Census Bureau did is provided what is called small area tabulations and sent it sort of a team of researchers to work with the Army in San Francisco to do the operational plan for the evacuation.
Would it be legal for data gathered from a citizenship question on the census to be used, for instance, to target undocumented immigrants today? Are there legal restrictions on how that information can be used?
Yes, that would be illegal today. And during World War II, when the census data, what are called microdata, in other words, the individual answers, either on economic censuses or on the population census, they were authorized in law in the Second War Powers Act to be used for the prosecution of the war. That piece of legislation was repealed after the Second World War and has never been challenged since. So this would be very much illegal to do now.
Do you think that the census has generally gotten more accurate and more reflective of the American population and our society since it began?
Yes. Well, certainly it's gotten more accurate because we've gotten the development of statistics and computerization and all the technologies that we use now to measure all sorts of things. So, yes, it's more accurate. It's still there was a period roughly from the 70s through the early 2000s when the hot button issues about the census were the undercount, which is differential. In other words, it's harder to count some people than other people. And when it became clear that there were political implications of that in the one person, one vote decisions and on the civil rights laws, local jurisdictions sued the Census Bureau and said, look, you got to do better on this. And over 30, 40 years, they have done better. There are still overcounts and undercounts and errors in the census. We all know that. They try to keep them to a minimum, and they tell you about where they are and what they are. We had a debate over whether to adjust the census for that era and decided as a country not to after the 2000 census.
Margo, thank you so much for joining us today. It was very interesting.
You're welcome.
Margo Anderson is a professor emerita at UW-Milwaukee and the author of several books, including The American Census, A Social History. She joined us to talk about the history of the census after President Trump said this week that he still wants to make details on citizenship part of the next questionnaire.
Making fundamental changes to our democracy and society can take a lot of time and political effort. And when things do change, they're often designed, if they can be, to stay that way. But sometimes even long-held institutions do change for better or worse. Our next guest says the U.S. is no stranger to uprooting entrenched institutions, having done away with things like the landed aristocracy and slavery. And more profound changes to our society might not be far off as we contend with issues of inequality and political power. Paul Starr is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. He's the author of the book Entrenchment, Wealth, Power and the Constitution of Democratic Societies, which comes out today. Paul, welcome to Central Time.
Rob, glad to be with you.
Well, the core idea in your book, the first word of the title, entrenchment. What do you mean by that?
I'm talking in this book about changes at a very fundamental level that become hard to reverse. And so you can think about our Constitution, which is difficult to amend. So when a country adopts a constitution, it's often making a certain set of rules very hard to change. But think of a constitution more generally, not just what's in a constitution formally, but other aspects of society that are also really fundamental and become hard to change. So one of the things I talk about in the book has to do with the rules of inheritance that used to maintain the power of landed aristocracies. And so those are the rules of primogeniture, for example, that concentrated all wealth in the eldest son. And that contributed to the maintenance of a very narrow class of landed aristocrats, who in England, for example, dominated that country for centuries. Slavery, as you mentioned, that's another example of a system of social rules that concentrated power in a dominant class. And we have our struggles today over the concentration of wealth and power. And what I've tried to do in this book is to put those conflicts that we see today in some historical perspective.
And entrenchment isn't, as you write, inherently good or bad. It could be bad. It could be an institution like slavery. It could be something more positive like equality under the rule of law that could be enshrined in a constitution and legal codes and practice. It's kind of value neutral in some ways.
Yes, yes. The term itself is neutral. I mean, not all forms of it are neutral by any means. But yes, you can have entrenched rules that protect freedom, and you can have entrenched rules that protect slavery. Yes, they can be on both sides.
And talk about how things become entrenched. You see two paths. We might do something on purpose, like, say, write something down in a constitution, or it might evolve over time. I'm thinking of like the two-party system in the United States. It wasn't written in the Constitution. It came into being and kept self-reinforcing.
Exactly, exactly. So, right, I distinguish between what I call strategic entrenchment, where there's a very definite purpose. And a constitution is an example of that, where there was some thought given to making rules hard to change. But then there are other things that come about that really people didn't anticipate at the time would become fundamental and hard to change. And we have many examples of that. Yes, you mentioned the two-party system. This goes back to choices about elections, about electoral rules. In some countries, Britain and the United States, we've got rules that it's called first past the post. And we have these single district elections, and whoever gets a plurality of the votes, you don't necessarily have to get a majority, becomes, you know, the elected representatives. Other countries have systems of proportional representation, and those work very differently. They have different consequences for party systems. They have actually very dramatic consequences for the distribution of power. But what I argue in the book is that at the time these early decisions were made, people really didn't have a clear idea of what the long-run consequences would be.
Talking to Paul Starr about his new book out today, Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. I want to read a quote from your book. Two of the big past events you focus in on in the book are, as you mentioned, landed aristocracy, slavery. Now, here's a quote. No problem is more difficult for democracies than the entrenched power of concentrated wealth. Can you talk about how you see that today as an entrenched power in our American system?
Yeah, so we have a society that is both a capitalist economy and a democracy, and the forms of wealth have changed historically. Landed wealth is not as important as industrial and financial wealth today, and as the economy has changed, it's generated new concentrations, new forms of wealth, often very concentrated. And that creates new issues. So let me give you one contemporary example. When the internet was really first developing in the 1990s, people thought it was going to decentralize power, and it would create very widespread opportunity. And to some extent, it has. But in fact, the online economy now has become the basis of extraordinary concentrations of wealth and power. Facebook, Google, Amazon exercise just in this extraordinary power over our lives. The power that Facebook has accumulated, we've heard lots of stories about that in recent years. And many of us, most of us, didn't really see this coming. So as the economy evolves, it creates these new forms of wealth. And what we've seen actually going back now, to the period right after World War II, we've seen actually a tremendous increase in the concentration of wealth, in inequality of income. And that has created new problems, I think, for democracy. It's not just in the United States, but in Europe, too. and elsewhere.
And you see, you write that the framers of the Constitution and other early parts of the American system were suspicious of concentrated wealth, as you said, in a different form then. But why were they inherently worried that too much concentration of wealth, our system might be allergic to it?
Well, again, if you go back to the 18th century, the concern was about landed aristocracy. It was about the concentration of landed wealth. That made sense at a time of largely agrarian society. And and they're actually right. We now have a lot of historical evidence about concentration of landed wealth in a narrow class, societies that have very dominant landowning classes. And indeed, those countries have had great difficulty establishing stable democracies. So I think actually that Jefferson and others who were very concerned about changing the rules of inheritance, and this was a big issue at the time of the American Revolution, they were fundamentally right that if there had been a kind of landed aristocracy established in America, and in the South, slave plantations were that. So I'm not saying that it didn't happen at all. But I think if it happened more generally, it would have been a huge barrier to democracy in this country. But what they didn't see, of course, they couldn't see, was the emergence of industrial wealth and how that would become concentrated. And then in the late 19th century, with the rise of the trusts and the antitrust movement and so forth, there was a whole new set of conflicts. And so, this is just, it's a continuing issue in our country. It'll never go away.
Is there anything inherently wrong with not a landed aristocracy, not an industrial trust, but some people have been really successful and concentrated wealth in an internet company, say, is that inherently unhealthy for American representative government?
So I don't think wealth is unhealthy. I do think that monopoly is unhealthy. I do think that when there is an overweening concentration of wealth and power, that does have very serious implications for the ability of ordinary people to have a responsive and accountable government. So, yes, there is a point at which it becomes a problem, and that's why we need, I think, stronger enforcement of the antitrust laws, and I think progressive taxation has a real function in preventing that kind of inherited wealth from continuing to dominate a country from generation to generation.
We're talking with Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. His new book is Entrenchment: Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. Paul, I want to get into one more thread that you talk about in your book, a reaction, you say, in some ways, to concentrated wealth and power and the influence that it has, populist movements around the country, and the rise of a sort of strongman government in nations around the world. Can you spell out the connection?
Well, in some places, populist movements are a reaction against the concentration of wealth and power. But in other places, including, I think, the United States now, we see a kind of combination, a kind of hybrid, where you have concentrated wealth and populism kind of fused together. So that you have this really sort of strange bedfellows alliance of great wealth and populist politics.
Is there a sense you think that people feel like a elite class, sort of vaguely defined, has gotten things wrong, so that we turn to a successful person, maybe a different type of elite, to try to steer us out of it? Is that what you see spreading?
I think something else is also going on in the United States and in Europe, and that has to do with long dominant groups feeling that their power is slipping away, and that has I think, a lot to do with the changes that have taken place over the last half century in racial relations, in gender relations, that have upset those who've enjoyed positions of dominance, predominantly white men, looking at these changes and becoming fearful of what their implications are. And it's created a kind of alliance. This is this strange fusion of oligarchy and populism that we see in the United States and some European countries.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Mike on the line in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi, Paul. So two events that occurred in the last 20 years that are seemingly unconnected, Citizens United, and then the reduction of the press of newspapers and reporting across the country because of the expansion of the internet, kind of seems to be coming together and self influencing each other and helping to concentrate as well.
Mike, thanks for the call. So campaign finance, Citizens United and other decisions, and the decline of the media, how do you see them playing into this, if at all, Paul?
Okay, so I think the Citizens United decision is an example of how important our Supreme Court is in making decisions about how wealth gets translated into power. And so before that decision, corporations were not able to use their treasuries directly to finance political candidates. Those were rules that had existed for a century. And now that path is open. And I think that is a good example of the connection between wealth and power. Now, on the question of the decline of newspapers, that's actually something I've written about in a totally different context. And it's happening all over the country in states like Wisconsin and elsewhere, that local newspapers and regional newspapers have, you know, lost their advertising revenue, lost subscription revenue, and have shrunk. Some areas of the country are now what are called news deserts because they have no community newspapers at all. And there hasn't really been any kind of commensurate development of online news to make up for what's been lost at the local and regional level. So this is a real problem. I don't think it has the same origins. It's a separate problem. But I think it contributes to the weakening of democracy.
Thanks for the call. We're going out to Tom with us in Port Wing. Tom, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question in reverse to your concentration of wealth. But what about the concentration of debt in our society? For instance, the high $1 trillion plus that is college debt. How does that affect us?
Yeah, so that is a different kind of problem, although, you know, it's not unrelated because, you know, if you go back several decades, college education wasn't nearly as expensive, including public universities, nearly as expensive as it is now. And so we didn't see young adults being plunged into the kind of debt that they face now. And, you know, I think if we had had different political choices being made, many young people today would not be carrying that burden. And so, you know, it is related, I think, to the changes in power that have taken place over the last several decades.
Tom, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Paul Starr, author of the new book out today, Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. Paul, if we agree, if we take it as given that concentrated wealth and monopolies are bad for the American political system, but those have become, at least in some senses, entrenched, is it possible to do something about it?
Yeah, I think it's possible to do something about it, and I say that because Americans have done something about it in the past. I mean, just go back to the period in the late 19th and early 20th century when there were the trusts that, you know, dominated the oil industry and steel industry and other industries, and during the period in the early 20th century known as the Progressive Era, we had measures taken that broke up those trusts and limited their power. didn't, you know, we still had a capitalist economy, but there was a limitation that was put on the power of that kind of concentrated wealth. And so we have done, you know, at other periods. So I do think it's possible, and I think history should give us some encouragement.
You also worry, though, that things could change for the worst if some of the entrenched systems go away. You worry about things like constitutional conventions or one-party dominance of the court system could change things in ways that are hard to reverse. Can you talk about your, I guess, worst case?
Yeah, okay. So I am concerned about the direction of the Supreme Court. We mentioned the Citizens United decision. There are other areas, for example, antitrust and labor law, where the Supreme Court has really exercised, I think, is a very unfortunate influence on behalf of corporate power. But at this moment, things are still close enough on the Supreme Court. There was a recent decision where Justice Kavanaugh very surprisingly sided with the liberals on the court. This involves Apple, the Apple store, and the question of whether it was exercising, whether it's been exercising monopoly power. And, so at this point, I think things are still open enough. But frankly, and here's, I'm going to just be clear about my own political views. I think if President Trump has a second term, he will very likely be able to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg, maybe even Stephen Breyer. We'd go from a 5-4 court to a 7-2 court, and then you don't have the situation where a lone dissent on the conservative side can make a difference. And instead, I think the law would move very considerably to the right and for a very long time.
As we wrap up, from the eyes of just one citizen, one voter, these long-term entrenched historical trends can seem pretty big and hard to change. Is there something that individual people can do to turn against the tide here?
Well, it's what we've always been asked by our society to do, and that's to show up, to show up and vote, to show up and protest in some cases. That's it, showing up and doing our part. And for each one of us, it may seem small, but it is amazing what people can do when they get together.
We'll leave it there for now. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Paul Starr, professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University. We've been talking about his new book. It's out today. It's called Entrenchment, Wealth, Power, and the Constitution of Democratic Societies. Coming up after the news, we'll hear from two Republican state lawmakers. They'll join the show to talk about a set of bills aimed at improving water quality in Wisconsin, focusing in particular on pollutants in well water around the state. A lot of people in different regions of Wisconsin affected by that issue. Also coming up today on Central Time, we'll continue our series High Tolerance, looking at the impact of alcohol in Wisconsin. Among other things, we'll look at rural treatment of alcoholism and other addictions, and why it's so hard for many people to find that kind of treatment. You can follow all the coverage of alcohol in Wisconsin in this High Tolerance series. Just go to WPR.org/alcohol.